The Latin word for cross is the root word for our word crucial, meaning something critical or decisive. And that's the claim made for Christ's crucifixion by all the authors of the New Testament, that the cross is crucial. That improbably, one man's bloody execution 2,000 years ago on a hill outside Jerusalem was, as one writer put it, the decisive turning point of all the ages and of critical importance still for us today. And to see how that can be so, we're going to listen to Jesus interpret the cross in his own words, as I said, words spoken from the cross, words he carefully chose at great cost to himself, struggling against the slow process of asphyxiation he was experiencing as he pulled himself up against the nails to grab just enough breath to speak. And after being nailed to two beams of wood and hung before his enemies and mockers, the very first words that Jesus struggled to speak were a prayer. A prayer focused not on himself, but on the Jewish leaders who'd orchestrated his execution and the Roman soldiers who were carrying it out. What would we have prayed in his place, I wonder? If we'd had enough emotion left after the spitting and the scourging. Father, punish them. I think I might have prayed that. But Jesus opens his mouth and he prays in verse 34 in that passage there. Father, pardon them. Father, forgive them. Forgive my enemies. Forgive my torturers. Forgive my murderers. And forgive the very worst of human depravity. For us, the cross is a warm religious symbol. If it's not replaced with a tick on an Iceland hot cross bun, then it decorates our churches and perhaps adorns our necks. But for Jesus, the cross meant degradation and cruelty. Today it's against the Geneva Convention to publicly humiliate a prisoner of war. But that was what the cross was expressly designed to do. Its victims were pinned up like insects. They were exposed, naked or near naked, clothes gambled away beneath them, as people mocked them, as their humanity was chipped away by passers-by. It was sadistic and it was dehumanizing. It was the gleeful degradation of the weak by the strong. A crucifixion represents the very worst of human impulses, the ones that still ravage our world and sometimes seep in and fracture in a smaller way our own lives. And it is all of that that Jesus asks his Father to forgive. Jesus suffers the depths of human depravity, but he seeks a forgiveness that even reaches to those who've gone all the way into those depths. Look at the cross and see there the compassion of Jesus Christ. If we weren't convinced of that compassion because of the way he lived, surely we're convinced of his compassion from the way that he died. The love for the unlovely, the tortured praying for his torturers. But what does this have to do with you and with me? We're not, I trust, I suspect, murderers or torturers. A crucifixion has never entered our minds. But if we do look within to our worst thoughts and instincts, the worst fantasies we entertain about others, we might not have stooped so low, but can we really stand so tall? Can we pretend that none of the worst impulses that we see in the human heart also run through our heart? bubbling up in our fantasies and in our thoughts and sometimes in our words and even occasionally in our deeds. Here's a test. If we knew that tomorrow we'd wake up and there'd be a visible speech bubble over our heads all day, sharing every thought we had about somebody else, could we even bear to get out of bed? Would we dare to lift our gaze to meet somebody else's eyes? But Jesus' first word on the cross was, "Father, forgive them." And we'll see later in another reflection, Jesus' death on the cross secured the forgiveness that he was praying for, so that the Father did answer that prayer. Thousands of people in the weeks after Jesus' crucifixion found forgiveness through his death, including some who may have plotted his murder, including some who may have planned it and executed it. And if that forgiveness could reach those committing the very worst of human depravity, won't that forgiveness also reach us today? Whatever we've done, whatever we've said, whatever we've imagined, however bad it might be. If you know that you've harmed others, if you can begin to accept that you may have offended God, look up to Jesus with faith. Survey the wondrous cross and hear Jesus' prayer of pardon, "Father, forgive them," and know that he prays that prayer for you and that his death secures that pardon for you. We're now going to enter our first moment of silence for personal meditation. And it may be hard to know what to do with that time. It can take a while to get into the groove and to slow down, and that's okay. But maybe this will help. And why not take those words of Jesus, "Father, forgive them," and think through some of the worst impulses in yourself that you can see, the words and deeds that you most regret, and hear Jesus pray that prayer for you. "Father, forgive Joe. Father, forgive me." And reflect that God delighted to give pardon through the cross in answer to that prayer on the cross. What did those watching see as Jesus hung there slowly dying on the cross? And the rulers sneer. "He saved others, let him save himself." The soldiers treat him with the same contempt, bored now of gambling clothes. "If you are the king of the Jews, save yourself." Even another crucified man, dying just like Jesus, beaten and bleeding just like him, sees Jesus as more pathetic than himself. He hurls insults. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." They saw a failure. Helpless to help himself, let alone anyone else. But one person there saw things differently. Earlier, two other gospel accounts tell us the second criminal, hung on the other side of Jesus, had joined in the insults. But now he's stopped. Why? Well, this man has recognized his own wrongness. Verse 41, speaking to the other criminal, "We are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve." And then in comparison, he recognizes Jesus' rightness, his perfect innocence, that the only man on a cross that day, in fact, the only man on that violent hill that day who doesn't deserve a cross, is the one between the two of them. But he also recognizes that Jesus isn't a failure, but the Savior King that he claimed to be. He doesn't know how, he doesn't know when, but somehow, this man has come to believe that this bruised and battered and bleeding figure nailed to the cross next to him will come through the cross to take a kingdom and be in a position to save others. And so the criminal goes one step further and he dares to reach out to Jesus, trusting that maybe he can be saved too. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Remember there, meaning not recall me, but rescue me. And Jesus responds with the second word that we contemplate at the foot of the cross today. Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. Let's just take a moment to savor every angle of our Savior's reply there. So it's a promise. Truly, I tell you, you will be with me in paradise. And it's personal. It's not some will be with me. You will be with me. And it's intimate. You will be with me. And it's more than expected. Perhaps this man had heard Jesus pray for the pardon of his own murderers, and perhaps he'd hoped that he might have a pardon from eternal death, from distance from Yahweh forever, from the Lord forever. But Jesus doesn't just grant him a pardon, which he does implicitly, he also grants him paradise. Not only rescue from the hell he deserves, but entry into the heaven that he doesn't deserve. Here's a man who has done nothing to earn this paradise. He's a criminal bad enough that in his own estimation, he deserves crucifixion. And he's a man who can do nothing to earn paradise. His hands are literally nailed to a cross. He can't do anything. But he does reach out to Jesus, and he receives from Jesus the promise of paradise. Look up at the cross and see there the generosity of Jesus, freely giving what none can purchase. Presbyterian minister Alistair Begg rather fancifully imagines the conversation that might have happened when this criminal finally breathed his last and comes to the gates of paradise. And the angel is standing there, and in this imaginary conversation, he asks, "Show me your record." Believe me, you don't want to see that. "Well then, pass me a copy of your baptism certificate." "I haven't got one." "Well, okay then, explain this Christian faith you've come into. How does it work?" "I wish I'd had time to learn more, but I didn't." "Then why are you here?" "Because the man on the middle cross said I could come." And for us, if we're to enter paradise, our answer must be the same. When you look to Jesus on the cross, do we see someone there who can and who wants to not only grant you pardon, but paradise? And do you realize that you need him to grant it to you in order to receive it? If we have asked Jesus to remember us, to save us, then as we go into this next time of silence, then maybe we can keep running through those words of his, emphasizing a different word at each point. The promise, you will be with me. The personal, you, yes, even you, will be with me. The intimacy, you will be with me. And the perfection to come, you will be with me in paradise. Of all the words that Jesus speaks from the cross, this word is probably the hardest to hear and possibly the hardest to understand. And yet it's also the word that gets closest to the heart of what was happening that day on the cross. It is, if you like, the crux of the cross. And there at the end of verse 34 in our reading, translated for us, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And Jesus is quoting Psalm 22 that we heard read earlier. But before, when his closest friends had abandoned him, he'd borne it in silence. Even the physical pain and the humiliation of the crucifixion hadn't brought out cries of despair. But now he knows that God has abandoned him. A fact underlined by the miraculous daytime darkness that looms over him. A sign of divine judgment. Just like the darkness came over Egypt in the days of Moses, just before the Passover lamb and the firstborn sons were killed. Now darkness has come upon Jesus, just before the perfect Passover lamb and the Son of God is to be killed. And so Jesus cries out in spiritual agony, the agony of one who knows for the first time the experience of God's pleasure withdrawing from him, and the experience of God's displeasure, God's judgment, resting upon him. But why? Why of all men was Jesus forsaken to judgment on the cross? To secure the pardon that he had prayed for his murderers, and to secure the paradise that he'd promised the criminal next to him. And he was forsaken, and he chose to be forsaken to secure our pardon and our entry into paradise, but to do so justly. And we instinctively, I think, rail against the idea of a God who judges. Certainly when we're in a comfortable place without much trouble. But we also long for justice. And when we hear of rapes and of war crimes, and when we feel the lesser wrongs that are done to us that can still never be fully made right in this world, the scabs that never really fully heal. And we don't want God to care less about all of that than we do. And he doesn't. His love is too strong to allow the abuse of his creatures, to allow offense against him, their precious creator, to go without justice. His love is too strong for that. And so in love for us, God the Father willingly sent the Son to die in our place. And God the Son willingly went to die in our place. And in Jesus Christ, the judge was judged for our offenses against him and against others. He faces divine displeasure so that we can know the pleasure of the divine pardon. And he experienced hell on the cross so we could experience heaven with him. As we heard read from the prophecy in Isaiah 53, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquity. And we heard that song from the choir just now, a lamentation for an entire city annihilated because of its sin. So terrible was what Jesus experienced that those verses were quickly used to describe his experience as he was abandoned and annihilated for others' sin. He was forsaken so that we might be close. Look up in the cross and see the sacrifice of Jesus. he cried out, "Why have you forsaken me?" so that we would never have to make that cry. Who did he stay on the cross for? Whose judgment did he take? The judgment for all who believe. We'll hear later the choir sing, "God so loved the world that whoever believeth in him, the Son, should not perish, but have everlasting life." The judgment of any who reach out to him with trust, like the criminal in our last reading. Because when we reach out with trust, we're actually joined to Jesus, a little bit like in a marriage. So I won't go into all of the details, but when I was married to my wife, Zanny, one of us had debts and the other of us had savings. And the one with savings took on the debts, and the one with savings shared those savings, because the two had become one flesh. And the same is true for all of those joined to Jesus Christ. He gladly absorbs the debt of our sin so that we are pardoned, and he gladly shares with us his savings, the joy of paradise, because two have become one. We might still wonder, can it be truly just, though, for an innocent man to die in the place of the guilty? If that's a question that you'd like to think about a little bit more, please do take a copy of this little book by Rebecca McLaughlin, Is Easter Unbelievable? It does address that sort of question, along with other questions about the plausibility of the Easter story. We've got a good number of copies at the back, and they're there to be taken. Please take one as an Easter gift from us. But if we can see that Jesus was forsaken so that we could be brought close, pardoned and with paradise to come, then perhaps in the silence that's about to come, maybe we can imagine what it might have been like for Jesus. Just begin to imagine for Jesus to say those words for us and to hear nothing back but silence, to experience only God's just displeasure. And then maybe sit in awe and give thanks, knowing that you will never have to cry these words because he cried them for you. It is finished is only one word in Greek, tetelestai, or mashalem, or mashalam in the language of Aramaic, which Jesus spoke. One word, but in it, as 19th century preacher Charles Spurgeon put it, there is an ocean of meaning in a drop of language. Jesus says, "It is finished." But he doesn't mean, "I'm over, I'm done for, I failed." Jesus is looking back at the race of his life and the last lap of his slow and agonizing crucifixion, which is now coming to an end, and he can say, "I have completed everything. I have accomplished everything. I'm about to cross the line. It is finished." What had he completed? All the work that his heavenly Father had given him to do. A life of obedience and then abandonment on the cross. on the cross. He drank the cup of God's judgment on sin right down to the dregs. Not a drop left. So that he might have the pardon that he prayed for. So that we might have the pardon that he prayed for. The pardon that even murderers might receive. He had gone through hell for us, so that we might have heaven. He had finished it all. And so he speaks that one last word of confident completion. And he bows his head and he gives up his spirit. Look up at the cross and see the glory of Jesus Christ. At that moment of apparent defeat, he experienced total triumph. The victim had become the victor. Good Friday would be followed by Easter Sunday. It is finished, and he has finished it. And that means he has finished it for us. The pardon and paradise that he perfectly won for us are not earned, but they're received with simple faith, simple trust. He has done it. But we don't always find that easy to accept. There's a film, Saving Private Ryan, and in it, Ryan, this young soldier, is rescued by a platoon of other soldiers. A number of them die in order to rescue him. And at the end of the rescue, as the platoon commander is lying dying, he looks up at Ryan, having given his life for Ryan, and he looks into Ryan's eyes, and he says two final words: earn it. And years later, as the film comes to an end, we see Ryan, now an old man, standing by the commander's graveside, collapsing in tears, wondering whether he has done enough, whether he has done enough to deserve the sacrifice of his fallen comrades, whether he's really earned it. And many of us who have taken the message of the depths of what Jesus went through for us to heart, and do love the pardon and the paradise that he has given us, will sometimes have wondered, may sometimes wonder, but have I done enough? Have I earned the sacrifice that Jesus made for me? And in our most self-aware moments, we're well aware the answer would be no. But Jesus did not look down from the cross and cry out, "Earn it." Jesus looks down to us, he fixes his gaze on us, eye to eye, and he promises, "It is finished." In every moment, all through life, this word is where we can return again and again and again. When you doubt that you can really receive pardon for your failures this time, the same failure again, Jesus still says to the believer, "It is finished." When you fear that God might not grant you paradise in the end because you haven't put in enough effort, you haven't shown enough passion, you haven't had enough self-sacrifice, you haven't had enough, hear Jesus say, "It is finished." Who will you trust? Your worries or my word? As we enter this final time of silence, if you believe that Jesus died on the cross for you and endured it for you, if you know that he has given pardon and peace and you've turned to him to receive that, why not take those words, "It is finished," and rub them into every worry, rub them into every doubt, into every regret, into every place that our conscience might be pricked. And think to yourself, yes, I have an unlikely forgiveness, I have an undeserved paradise. But I really have them. Because Jesus was forsaken for me. And he has said, it is finished.